Continuing with our chapter, Unsupported and Unsupportive Consciousness. This next sutta quotation comes from the sutta called the Simile of the Snake, sutta number 22 in the Majjhima Nikaya. So this is still talking about consciousness which is unsupported. Bhikkhus, when the gods, with Indra and with Brahma and with Prajapati, seek a bhikkhu who is thus liberated in mind, they do not find anything of which they could say, the consciousness of one thus gone is supported by this. Why is that? One thus gone is untraceable here and now. And notably, the Buddha is using the word Tathagata for any enlightened being. It's not just using that term to refer to his own nature, but a slightly less common use of that as a general term for an enlightened being. As with that earlier encounter, the sutta from the Book of the Elevens in the Anguttara Nikaya, and to a superior person meditating in this way, the gods together with Indra, the Brahmas and their chief queens pay homage even from afar. Homage to you, O superior one. Homage to you, O superlative one, of whom we have no direct knowledge, even of what it is that you meditate dependent upon. So it's highlighting that quality of wisdom, this quality of liberation, is something that is outside the scope of even the most refined and elevated qualities of being. So even these super refined beings up in the upper stratosphere of the Buddhist cosmology, that it's a mode of being, if you like, or a quality of awareness which is not within their scope, or they cannot define. It's not within the bounds of the conditioned realm to be definable. So that they cannot say the consciousness of one thus gone is supported by this. And similarly, I like to regularly quote that dialogue between the Buddha and Vachagota, where the Buddha says that material form or feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness, whereby one trying to define the Tathagata would define him, that's been cut off at the root, made like a palm tree stump, deprived of the conditions for existence and been rendered incapable of arising in the future. The Tathagata is liberated from being reckoned in terms of form, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness. He is profound, immeasurable, unfathomable, like the great ocean. So there's that quality of presence that is the word Tathagata, or awakened awareness. The Vijja Dhatu is another way of referring to that, the element of awakened awareness, the element of knowing that can't be defined in terms of the five khandhas. This next sutta is also quite a well-known one, and it's found in the Nidanavaga, chapter 12 of the Connected Discourses, sutta number 64. There are these four nutriments. So nutriment, the English word, means a kind of food. So in Pali, it's ahara. There are these four nutriments for the establishing of beings who have taken birth, or for the support of those in search of a place to be born. What for? Physical food, gross or refined. That's the first one. Contact as the second. Consciousness, the third. And intention is the fourth. So that is the physical food. Then contact is passa. Then consciousness, vijnana, and chetana, intention, is the fourth. These are the four nutriments for the establishing of beings who have taken birth, or for the support of those in search of a place to be born. When there is passion, delight, and craving for the nutriment of physical food, consciousness lands there and grows. It's a very technical way of talking about what happens in your mind at 10:45 in the morning, or 7:15 in the morning, with a very sharp focus of concentration at 7:15, I've noticed. Breakfast is potential. Nothing personal, I'm not spying on anyone, it's just the general circumstances of monastery life. Where consciousness lands and grows, mentality, materiality alights. Where mentality, materiality alights, there is the growth of volitional formations. Where there is the growth of volitional formations, there is the production of renewed becoming in the future. Where there is the production of renewed becoming in the future, there is birth, aging, and death, together, I tell you, with sorrow, affliction, and despair. Just as when there is dye, lac, yellow or pigment, indigo or crimson, a dyer or a painter would paint the picture of a woman or a man, complete in all its parts, on a well-polished panel or a wall or a piece of cloth. In the same way, where there is passion, delight and craving for the nutriment of physical food, consciousness lands there and grows. So on and so forth, together I tell you, with sorrow, affliction and despair. So it's interesting in that sequence. You have consciousness landing and growing, that conditions nama-rupa, materiality and mentality. Where mentality, materiality alights, there grows volitional formation. So then the nama-rupa conditions sankhara. And when there's the growth of volitional formations, then there is the production of renewed becoming. That's punabhava is the Pali for that, again becoming. Where there is production of renewed becoming in the future, there's birth, aging and death, together, I tell you, with sorrow, affliction and despair. So you have some of the familiar elements of the dependent origination cycle, that process, but they're in a slightly different order than what is familiar. So it's another example of how the Buddha is speaking about these causal processes, one thing conditioning another, that they don't always match up with each other sort of perfectly and logically in a systematic way every time. So this is one of those instances. And then also repeats the same words with the three other kinds of nutriment. So what he's saying with respect to physical food, then he says the same with contact, passa, that's sense contact. And the definition of contact is the sense organ, like the eye, the sense object, like visible forms, and then the consciousness that arises when, say, the light from the visible form meets the eye and the consciousness arises, the meeting of the three is defined as passa, or contact. And then vijnana is the third of the four kinds of ahara, or nutriment, and intention, chetana, is the fourth. Then he goes on to say, where there is no passion for the nutriment of physical food, where there is no delight, no craving, then consciousness does not land there or grow. Mentality, materiality, does not alight, does not land upon them. There is no growth of volitional formations. There is no production of renewed becoming in the future. Where there is no production of renewed becoming in the future, there is no birth, aging and death. That, I tell you, is quite free from sorrow, affliction and despair. And also the way that those things are conditioning or affecting each other, there's a slight sort of difference in language. You've got consciousness does not land, so you've got that motif of landing. Then materiality, mentality does not alight, does not kind of hit that particular spot. And then there's no growth, rising up of volitional formations, and then there's no sort of sprouting into, there's no production of renewed becoming in the future. So the way that those different forms of conditioning are described by the Buddha, there's a slight difference between each of those connections. So then he comes up with this very interesting, very compelling image to illustrate this. Just as if there were a roofed house or a roofed hall having windows on the north, the south or the east, when the sun rises and a shaft of light has entered by way of the window, where does it land? On the western wall, Venerable Sir. And if there is no western wall, on the ground, Venerable Sir. And if there is no ground, on the water, Venerable Sir. And if there is no water, it does not land, Venerable Sir. And the Buddha summarizes that. In the same way, when there is no passion for physical nutriment, contact, consciousness, or intention, consciousness does not land or grow. That, I tell you, is quite free from sorrow, affliction, or despair. That image of the sunlight coming in the window as it rises in the east in the morning with no place to land, then that beam of sunlight doesn't have a landing place. And that's the image that the Buddha uses in that particular sutta. So that's Sutta 64 in the Connected Discourses on Causation. So any questions, thoughts, comments on that? Yes?
What is the Pali term that he uses for volitional formations in that?
Sankhara, I'm pretty sure.
Mano Sanchetana.
Pardon?
Mano Sanchetana, for volitional formations.
Yeah, well, in the nutriment.
So where it says there is the growth of volitional formations, that's Mano Sanchetana.
Yeah, as in nutriment. It's also interesting. That's why I was getting the number, because in different suttas, the order is a little bit different.
Mm-hmm. Can you remember how?
Consciousness, if I remember correctly, this is a big if, then consciousness is last, Mano Sanchetana is third. Mm-hmm. The first two are the same.
have a question. To dissociate, isn't it like to withdraw? It feels like something violent. It is kind of, I think it's something painful. Dissociate.
Well, non-attachment or non-entanglement, I don't see how that's violent.
But to dissociate, isn't it like to withdraw?
No, it means to be dissociated from something is just not to be connected with it, or not to be entangled or up close. The English doesn't imply anything necessarily violent. So to associate means to draw close. Dissociate is to draw away. It doesn't have anything necessarily unwholesome to it. It's just inclining away from something that is unpleasant or unwholesome.
So how is it called when you kind of, you know, you have a thought you don't like, and then you just like, you hit, in a way, you hit it away, you kind of...
You don't have to.
Sort of suppressing it. Or a child says something and you say to it, stop talking, I don't want to hear it, like, you know.
Well, that's one of the ways of dealing with distracted thought, but it's sort of at the extreme end. The first choice is to direct the attention away from it or to simply let go of it. If it is very persistent and very strong, then the Buddha speaks about using this kind of more aggressive modes, which are there. So just as like a strong man will hold down a weaker man, kind of like a wrestler. That's sort of number five on the list of five. But if you look at the sutta called The Removal of Distracted Thought, sutta number 20 in the Majjhima Nikaya, there's these five different modes that the Buddha describes, going from the most sort of subtle and delicate to the most extreme. So, yeah, the last one, the sort of fifth on the list, is pretty violent. It's like, and then he uses these different images to describe those. But the first few are quite sort of gentle, and that's that your first approach is to just turn your attention away from something, just as like you are, say, looking at the image of something and you just turn your advert your attention away from the image that you're looking at. Or if you need to apply a little bit more strength, then it's just like taking a small peg to knock out a big peg. It's so that you use a skillful thought to substitute for an unskillful thought. Mm-hmm. But you find it interesting, there's a very helpful sutta, the Vitakka Santana Sutta. But dissociation, in English, is not intrinsically a kind of an aggressive or unwholesome term. Just like Lumpo Pasanno was talking about the Buddha choosing to incline away from the yakko with the bristly fur on his skin, Suchiloma. It's like he was choosing to dissociate from that or draw away from that. It's a movement away, that's what the word means, but it doesn't have to be unskillful.
It's a tool and it needs to be used in a proper way.
Yeah. That's like drawing close to that when the Buddha says Tathagata's delight in empty places. When an Atapindika wants to offer the Buddha a residence, a monastery, what kind of place can I offer you? And the Buddha says, Tathagata's delight in empty places. An Atapindika thinks, okay, I'll find some kind of quiet place outside of the city of Savatthi. That'll be a peaceful, quiet place that will be pleasing to the Tathagata.
Here I lost the context.
Well, that's like choosing to associate, going towards something, rather... Wow. As the opposite example.
Ah, yes.
Just as the Buddha can choose to move away from or move towards, but those kind of qualities of choosing are not intrinsically unwholesome. Like the Buddha saying to the yakka, your touch is unpleasing to me. Some kind of polite way of, your touch is off-putting. You're bristly like a hedgehog, you know. So. He doesn't say it quite like that. But. Okay, so to continue. The next passages come from the Sutta Nipata, which is a whole collection of teachings in verse, and I was reading that translation by Dr. Saratissa a couple of days ago. One who is independent does not tremble. One who is dependent clutches, grasps existence one way or another, and thus is unable to escape samsara. Consider this dark consequence. There is danger in dependence. Therefore, relying on nothing, the mindful bhikkhu travels on, free from clinging. So that phrase, danger in dependence, speaking about the Dhamma side of things. On the Vinaya side, when someone enters the Sangha as a 10-precept nun or a 10-precept samanera or as a bhikkhu, then you deliberately take dependence. It's called nisaya, so that you're formally requesting to be dependent, which is the Vinaya side of it. On the Dhamma side, then we incline towards independence. So it can sound like they're opposite, they are contradictory. A very regularly quoted dialogue between Lumpo Cha and the young Bhikkhu Sumedho, that Lumpo Sumedho is often quoted. One day Lumpo Cha said to him, "Sumedho, you must be confused." He's kind of wondering what was coming. So why is that, Lumpo? I said, "Well, the Dhamma is all about letting go and the Vinaya is all about holding on." He thought, "Yeah, actually, come to think of it, that is confusing." And then, as he said, he thought that Lumpo Cha was going to go into some helpful, detailed explanation about that relationship or how that works together. But all he said was, "When you figure out how those work together, you'll be fine." And that was it. That's the Dhamma of the middle way. The Vinaya and precepts and skillful living is all about working with the conditioned, and then the realization of Dhamma is seeing things in the context of the unconditioned. When it talks about there is danger in dependence, then it's talking about that mental attitude of clinging, grasping, entanglement. Anything you would say on that, Lumpo?
You really realize how this middle way sometimes is not completely logical, you know, or if you follow the strict interpretation of a word just like that, you know, pulling away, drawing close, and there's things that you draw close to because they're skillful, they're beneficial, things you pull away from because they're not, and it's finding what really helps the mind. Again, it's coming back to that experiential clear seeing of an ending of this is suffering, this is the ending of suffering.
And it's about this skillful relationship to those qualities. So, for example, in the previous reading where it says, where there is passion, delight, and craving for the nutriment of physical food, consciousness lands there and grows. Doesn't mean to say that we stop eating. Food is intrinsically dangerous or bad, or we should all be just living on light and such like. But rather, being aware that that's the chemistry of it. Where there is passion, delight, and craving for the nutriment of physical food, consciousness lands there and grows. And then if those passion, delight, and craving are followed, then the end result is dukkha. But when there is no passion, where there is no delight, no craving, consciousness does not land or grow. Again, it doesn't mean to say that we don't eat, but rather there's the relationship of mindfulness and wisdom in relationship to physical food and then to contact, to consciousness and to intention. Seeing the feeling, knowing those qualities with mindfulness and wisdom rather than passion and craving and nandiya, delight, then there's a skillful relationship to that. So that taking physical food is, as we recite in the reflection on the four requisites, only for the maintenance of the body, enabling to support the practice of Dhamma. That's what we are eating for, is to maintain physical well-being in order to support this life. That's the main purpose of it. That's the principle behind it. Only for the maintenance and nourishment of this body, for keeping it healthy, and for the practicing of the holy life. Okay, then to continue, this is a dialogue between the Buddha and his son, Rahula. This is one of the discourses the Buddha's giving meditation advice to Rahula. Rahula, develop meditation that is like space. For when you develop meditation that's like space, arisen, agreeable, and disagreeable contacts will not invade your mind and remain. Just as space is not established anywhere, so too, Rahula, develop meditation that is like space. For when you develop meditation that's like space, arisen, agreeable, and disagreeable contacts will not invade your mind and remain. That reminded me of the passage from the Questions of King Milinda, the dialogue between the monk Nagasena and Milinda. And when Nagasena is giving descriptions of Nibbana, he says, just as space is not produced, does not age, does not suffer death, does not pass out of existence, does not come into existence, cannot be forcibly handled, cannot be carried away by thieves, rests on nothing, is the pathway of birds, presents no obstacles, and is endless, So also Nibbana is not produced, does not age, does not suffer death, does not pass out of existence, does not come into existence, cannot be forcibly handled, cannot be carried away by thieves, rests on nothing, is the pathway of the noble, presents no obstacles, is endless. And the word for space is akasa. Akasa, like in the Thai language, agat, I believe comes from akasa, which means atmosphere or the air. Yes.
What was the Rahula Sutta?
It's number 62 in the middle-length discourses. I think it's the Maha Rahulavada Sutta.
Yes.
The greater discourse of advice to Rahula. The commentaries say that the one where the Buddha's talking about the importance of not lying and telling the truth, it's supposed to be when Rahula's quite young. The commentaries say this is when Rahula was a teenager, was a bit older. Oh, yes.
This sutta, the Buddha goes through the elements. And I'm just recalling that here it says because space is not established anywhere, but do you remember what he says for earth and water and when he says, you know, make your mind like the earth or make your mind?
It's quite different. The tone is, be like the earth, Rahula, because the earth, if something foul or poisonous or disgusting is put onto the earth is not... It's not upset, it's not irritated, it's completely equanimous. So it's about equanimity. So the one on space, it's got a bit of a different tone.
Okay.
As I recall.
Yeah, each is appropriate for its quality. It's for equanimity.
The earth is.
Yeah, more sort of the unshakable kind of feeling. Primal.
Okay, so to continue. A final discourse that refers to this area sums up the essence of these teachings very succinctly. It also presages some other teachings that we'll look at in the upcoming chapters, notably those in chapter 9 and chapter 11, where the Buddha speaks of how to evade the king of death by meditating on emptiness, and in chapter 12 on the Heart Sutra. And this one is from the Mara Sanyutta, the connected discourses about Mara, that's chapter 4 of the Sanyutta Nikaya, sutta number 19. Chapter 4 of the Sanghita. At Sarvati. Now on that occasion, the Blessed One was instructing, exhorting, inspiring, and gladdening the bhikkhus with a Dhamma talk concerning Nibbana. And those bhikkhus were listening to the Dhamma with eager ears, attending to it as a matter of vital concern, applying their whole minds to it. Then it occurred to Mara, the evil one, this ascetic Gotama is instructing, exhorting, inspiring, and gladdening the bhikkhus, who are applying their whole minds to it. Let me approach the ascetic Gotama in order to confound them. As with the assembly of Brahma, like, oh dear, these teachings are getting through. This is dangerous. I'm going to lose some beings that are confined to my realm. I'm going to lose a few of those that have been under my power. So Mara, the evil one, thinks, let me go to the ascetic Gotama to confound them. And confounding means confusing or distracting, making them kind of puzzled or filled with doubts. And obstructed. Then Mara, the evil one, manifested himself in the form of a farmer, carrying a large plough on his shoulder. So this is not the kind of plough that we have nowadays. In India, Southeast Asia, it's a bit smaller, it's more kind of handy that would go behind a water buffalo, rather than a whole kind of big mechanical arrangement. So the farmer had this plough, a wooden plough, over his shoulder. Holding a long goad stick, that's a stick for tapping the water buffalo, his hair disheveled, untidy, wearing hempen garments, his feet smeared with mud. He approached the Blessed One and said to him, maybe you've seen oxen, ascetic, like, you know, have you seen my cows? Trying to pretend to be a farmer. This is Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation. What are oxen to you, evil one? So the Buddha recognizes who it is straight away, but Mara carries on regardless, as if the Buddha hasn't spotted him. So he says, this is the farmer speaking. The eye is mine, ascetic, the eye, like the visual organ. Forms are mine. Eye contact and its base of consciousness are mine. Where can you go, ascetic, to escape from me? The ear is mine, ascetic. Sounds are mine. The nose is mine, ascetic. Odors are mine. The tongue is mine, ascetic. Tastes are mine. The body is mine, ascetic. Tactile objects are mine. The mind is mine, ascetic. Mental phenomena are mine. mind contact and its base of consciousness are mine. Where can you go, ascetic, to escape from me? And the Buddha responds, the eye is yours, evil one. Forms are yours. Eye contact and its base of consciousness are yours. But, evil one, where there is no eye, no forms, no eye contact and its base of consciousness, there is no place for you there, evil one. The ear is yours, evil one. Sounds are yours. Ear contact and the base of consciousness are yours. But, evil one, where there is no ear, no sounds, no ear contact and its base of consciousness, there is no place for you there, evil one. The nose is yours, evil one. Odors are yours. Nose contact and its base of consciousness are yours. But, evil one, where there is no nose, no odors, no nose contact and its base of consciousness, there is no place for you there, evil one. The tongue is yours, evil one. Tastes are yours. Tongue contact and its base of consciousness are yours. But, evil one, where there is no tongue, no tastes, no tongue contact and its base of consciousness, there is no place for you there, evil one. The body is yours, evil one. Tactile objects are yours. Body contact and its base of consciousness are yours. But, evil one, where there is no body, no tactile objects, no body contact and its base of consciousness, there is no place for you there, evil one. The mind is yours, evil one. Mental phenomena are yours. Mind contact and its base of consciousness are yours. But, evil one, where there is no mind, no mental phenomena, no mind contact and its base of consciousness, there is no place for you there, evil one. Then Mara responds to that by saying, that of which they say, it's mine, and those who speak in terms of mine, if your mind exists among these, you won't escape me, ascetic. The Buddha responds, that which they speak of is not mine. I'm not one of those who speak of mine. You should know thus, O evil one, even my path you will not see. Then Mara, the evil one, realizing the blessed one knows me, the fortunate one knows me, sad and disappointed, disappeared right there. That's another wonderful dialogue between the Buddha and Mara. And that chapter of the Connected Discourses has got a number of encounters like that. But it's kind of interesting that even though the farmer speaks in a very philosophical way, first of all asking, have you seen my oxen? And then going into the eye is mine, forms are mine, and so on and so forth. But despite the content of what he says, the Buddha is not the slightest bit deluded and recognizes exactly what's going on and then is not taken in by that. That way of Mara saying the eye is mine, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, the mind, I would say insofar as those are taken to be who and what we are, they are a self or they belong to a self, then, as it says, we've gone over to Mara's side. And another teaching, it says, there are forms cognizable by the eye which are delightful, pleasing, attractive. And if one takes hold of them, relishes them, and binds the heart to them, then you've gone over to Mara's side and the evil one can do with you as he likes, quote unquote, which can sound a bit aggressive. That way of relating to the senses as not self, developing that insight in the meditation to the wise reflection of, well, there is seeing, there's hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking, but to say there is a thinker, there's a seer, there's a hearer, one who feels, that's additional, that's a presumption, that's a conceit that the mind is creating. In this dialogue, the Buddha is saying, yes, those all belong to you, Mara. That's all your territory, as long as they are held onto. But if the mind knows those as not self, as the Buddha says, that which they speak of is not mine, the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, the mind. I'm not one of those who speak of mine. You should know thus, O evil one, even my path you will not see. So it's a kind of mythological discussion or dialogue, but it's also played out in the meditation hall, you know, on the walking path and in our daily lives, the degree to which the mind takes hold of what we see and feel, what we remember, our emotions, our judgments, and make them who and what we are. I think, I feel, I remember. You are wonderful, you are awful. I am wonderful, I am awful. The degree to which the mind believes in those judgments and gives them substance is the degree to which we're under the rulership of Mara, the degree to which the mind knows that's an opinion, that's a memory, that's an emotion, that's a taste, that's a smell, that's a sound, doesn't mean that we are passive or not responding to those stimuli or those perceptions in a skillful way, but the mind is not creating a person out of them, that they're not a self, they don't belong to a self. Any comments on that sutta?
Not really. It's always just nice to sit back and listen.
Any questions? Or, yes.
Майсаджи Падана, we encourage this meditation to see, like for example, we observe skin as my skin, his skin, her skin, the same hair, the head. So we look at they are not different in me and other people. So it becomes not like my opinion and your opinion, but it's like a field of opinions, and whatever opinions are presented, you don't have preference for the one that you expressed, but any opinion that comes in, and the same like with sounds and so on. So would it be a kind of suitable object of meditation? Then it becomes just a field of experience, a field of sensing, and you don't extract the ones that are kind of yours.
Yeah, a day or two ago there was the section on Jhetanupassana. I would say that comes under that, so Jhetanupassana, recognizing the different mind states, wholesome and noble mind states, unwholesome and ignoble mind states, contracted mind states, agitated mind states. In oneself, it says contemplating internally, contemplating externally. So those states of mind or those forms, they might be in this mind, they might be in somebody else's mind, but they're all just forms of that nature, and establishing that mindfulness and seeing them just as, well, it's just a formation. That person is very excited, or I'm feeling very sad, or whether it's this person sad or that person sad, it's just a feeling of sadness. Or this person excited, or that person excited, or this person irritated, or that person irritated, it's just the feeling of irritation. So I'd put that in the Chittanupassana realm to a great extent. And also in Dhammanupassana, if you take the Dhamma with a big D rather than mental phenomena, meaning seeing things in terms of Dhamma, so that the fourth foundation is very much to do with, as is represented in the Anapanasati Sutta, when it talks, the fourth section of the Mindfulness of Breathing Sutta, is using the breath as a basis for contemplation of impermanence, arising and passing away, and developing wisdom and insight. So that with respect to moods and attitudes or thought forms in yourself and in others, that Dhammanupassana in terms of, oh, this has arisen here, or this has arisen there. I was feeling quite peaceful, and then this painful memory arose. And now, but it's an arisen thing. It's come into being, and then an hour later, oh, that painful memory that was in my mind an hour ago, I've completely forgotten about it. It's faded away altogether. Or in somebody else, that someone else has had a particular thought or a particular opinion or a particular mood. Oh, they didn't have that opinion before, now they do have that opinion. And then sometime later, oh, now it's faded away. So just seeing that basic framework of impermanence, as well as the framework of moods and thoughts as being aspects of nature, just like the shape of a leaf or a cloud or a spring flower or something. So I'd say that really in those two domains, and particularly I feel that understanding Dhammanupassana in terms of seeing things in a framework of Dhamma, and particularly applying that reflect on impermanence, that I feel that's the most helpful way of applying the Dhammanupassana, that fourth of the foundations. In a way, not looking at the content of your opinions or somebody else's opinions, or your moods or somebody else's moods, but deliberately looking at the process of how thoughts and memories, ideas, moods arise and pass away. So you're looking at the process of those forms, how they function, how they come into being and fade away, and deliberately not paying attention to the content, whether it's wholesome or unwholesome, whether it's in here or out there, but rather it's the changingness, the transient nature, which is really the kind of linchpin, the consent of insight meditation, is letting go of the content of the field of experience and looking at the process of experiencing. That makes sense.
in terms of the practice, you know, when something arising, it's like the whole energy and, you know, just like put your head in a spinner, and then it's not like you can't see, oh, it's just an emotion, but it's just like the whole thing would just fill it up and then spin, and then maybe a day, a week.
That's a long mood.
And then it's just, oh, it's just an emotion, it's just a thought. But
we were having a conversation, I think it was breakfast time a day or two ago, and I was recollecting that Lumpo Cha would say how when there's a mood arises, you can't just sort of snap your fingers, and sometimes it's so strong you're really carried away by it. But as soon as it's lowered to a degree where you can recognize, wow, this is a strong one, that's where you establish mindfulness. And even that, you can't stop it, but at least you know, oh, I'm in this mood. I've got on this train. The train isn't stopping, but I am on a train and it's going in this direction. And I found that very, very helpful advice. My memory is that I heard Lumpo Cha speaking about that when I was a novice, way back when, and one of the senior Western monks was translating. He said, yeah, you know, we get carried away by greed, by irritation, by fear, and that at first it might be something very strong, you've got no perspective on it, but at a certain moment, there's always going to be a thing of, wow, this is a strong one, or I'm really getting carried away. There's a moment along the way where it's lowered enough to be able to recognize this train is really moving. It doesn't stop the train. So you're carried along by that flow of feeling. And you know, oh, this is really stupid for me to be following this feeling of greed or fear, or, okay, well, I can't seem to stop it just by being aware of it, but okay, well, let's just mindfully watch where it goes. And as you're following that impulse and getting caught in it, then, okay, I'm eating far too much, and I'm aware I'm eating far too much, and my hand and my mouth are still not stopping. Not that that would ever happen with you, but it certainly happened in my life. Then when mindfulness can be established, recognizing, okay, well, where is this going to go? And then when it's finally come to a completion, you've finished all the food or you're completely stuffed, then, okay, now what's the result of having followed that? And looking at that in a kind of clear and uncomplicated way, like, okay, that impulse having been followed, whether it was greed for food or blowing up at somebody, being caught up in some kind of baseless anxiety or paranoid fear of some kind, then, okay, that was followed. How does it feel? Ow! This is where it led to. And then without creating self around it, acknowledging that was an impulse that was followed, this was the result of it, how does it feel? Ow! Here's the cause, here's the effect. So that's what leads to upekkha. The contemplation that supports upekkha is, I'm the owner of my karma, heir to my karma, born of my karma. So the contemplation of cause and effect, the hate point, that's what leads to upekkha. Not saying it's a good thing that you overate again, but rather, okay, I ate too much, and this is the result of it. The mind dull and heavy and filled with regret all afternoon. Still got indigestion into the evening. Ow! And so, once again, with equanimity and without building a self around it, here's the cause, here's the effect. And then the degree to which that can really be received then helps us to not get caught in the same process again. And Lumpo Pasano spent a lot more time with Lumpo Cha than I did, but that's one particular teaching about getting lost in states. You know. Greed for food was a very prominent feature in my life at that time, and so it particularly stuck with me. And also he had some tactics, like when he was a young monk and was getting caught up in things, he'd say, okay, mangoes, you want mangoes? I'll give you mangoes. He would sometimes overdo it deliberately to kind of, thus have I heard, that he saw his mind going crazy during mango season. He had a very big alms bowl, and so having allowed his alms bowl to be filled with mangoes, and knowing an abundance of mangoes at the mealtime, I heard that he ate 37 of them. Okay, you want mangoes? I'll give you mangoes. And then, no, we need more mangoes. 37 mangoes is what I heard. I don't know if you...
Yes.
It's So within the bounds of the precepts, giving the mind what it's asking for. Like, more mangoes will make you happy. Oh, really? Okay. More. In Shakespeare, the opening lines of Twelfth Night are, if music be the food of love, play on, so that surfeiting, like, by having too much, the appetite may sicken and so die. If mangoes be the food of bhikkhus, eat on, so that surfeiting, the appetite might sicken and so die. So in terms of getting swept up by the flood of moods.
Yeah, I mean, certainly for me, one of the things that I find was always very helpful and still helpful in mindfulness of the body. Because sometimes trying to catch mental states and trying to understand mental states, they're out of the station and you're left behind. But using the body as an anchor of attention and mindfulness, then it provides a much clearer mirror or clearer reflection of the impact of the particular moods and impulses. Then you start to feel the agitation or the heat or the, you know, whatever. And it's mirrored, I think, a lot more quickly. And certainly for me anyway. So using, really developing that mindfulness of the body as a mirror of the moods and impressions of the mind and the workings of the mind, especially restlessness or, you know, any mental state, you feel it in the body as well.
It's very interesting, particularly with greed, although when the mind is following what it takes to be pleasant experiences or pleasant sensations, the kind of karma raga, like eating mangoes, say for example, that the mind is naming it, oh, this is good, because there's a pleasant taste, or there's some kind of impact. But just as Lumpur Sanno was saying, if the mind is pursuing something that it's calling pleasant, and then you bring attention to how that actually feels in the body, it's quite shocking, because without any kind of commentary or sort of prejudgment, when the mind is following what it's calling a sort of pleasant state or getting more of a pleasant experience, it's quite uncomfortable, I find. Physically, it's not pleasant. There's a stressing in the body, also your breathing is constricted. Just the sheer physical sensation of following so-called, you know, pleasant experiences is like, oh, this is pretty awful. If you take away the kind of the pleasant sensation that's coming from what you're tasting or what you're seeing or hearing or whatever, just simple physical sensation on its own, it's quite surprising. Oh, why do I want more of this? This is quite uncomfortable. Why am I doing this to myself? This isn't very agreeable at all. But because the attention is going to the thing, the taste or the smell or the sound or the sight or whatever it is, then because it's focused on that particular sense door, it's not noticing the kaya-anupassana, the potaba, the physical sensation of it. So that, just on its own, is a really good thing to develop. Like, just to say, well, how does this feel in the body? And then, oh, this isn't very nice at all. And then letting that bring its own buffering or its own way of supporting that disentanglement, letting go, and getting off the train. Yes?
What you're describing to me has some resemblance with piti. It's exciting, like it's energetic, and it's like, for example, in samadhi, getting samadhi. And then you're like, oh, okay, this is nice. You're successful in your endeavor. And I was thinking, like, how would that relate to getting your desire fulfilled? Would that also be like a sense of piti? It's not peaceful, like it can be agitating, but it's also like exciting and energetic, and the result of that could be sukha or a sort of peace. So how would you relate to what I just shared?
Well, it's a good point. One of the frequent comments about piti, that rapture, is that it's not very peaceful and that it's got a kind of charged, exciting, there's a gratification that can come with it, like, wow, there's a quite a sort of bright, positive charged quality to it, but then by paying attention to that or feeling that, the physicality of it, it's like, oh, this isn't very peaceful. So in the teachings of the great Ajahns, often they'll mention that rapture is part of the meditation process, but it's not very peaceful, and it's not helpful to dwell in that or to feed that quality of piti on its own or to relish that. It's a stage that the mind can go through, and it's much more helpful for that to ripen into sukha, contentment, and that much more quiet quality of fulfillment or well-being, which is more mature. So it's pretty much always represented that sukha comes after piti. It's like a much more mature quality. Sukha is not as exciting or as like wow-ish as the electricity of rapture, of piti. It's more peaceful and it's more helpful in terms of supporting insight. And then ekagata, one-pointedness, is then what follows on beyond equanimity, and one-pointedness is what follows on beyond sukha. Sukha's still got a kind of emotional, a kind of tangible emotional tone to it. Kind of, it's more peaceful and more stable than piti, rapture. That emotional tone of it, the kind of warmth or quality of easefulness or comfort, that's something that then falls away at the next sort of stage. And the characterization of fourth jhana is equanimity and mindfulness, or equanimity and one-pointedness, the upekha and ekagata. If I'm remembering my points correctly. Any comments on that?
Yeah, so getting what one wants on a sort of sensory, sensual, worldly basis, it can be quite satisfying. But then the tendency, I think, is that if it's not really aligned with Dhamma, it starts feeding into a process of desire cycle. More refined, different, better. Whereas if it's aligned with Dhamma, the trajectory will be much more toward relinquishment or peace or more subtlety. Just that sense here with piti would be inclining more to, if you're feeding it with the aspect of Dhamma or it's aligning itself with Dhamma, it'll tend to quite naturally turn to more peaceful, turning to relinquishment, turning to settling.
Just having that energy running through the body, that can be quite addictive. And so it was one of the things comes up in leading meditation retreats, and I mean in the Sangha as well. Often on silent meditation retreats, then that's something that's quite an issue for some people, that they're really addicted to the energy of rapture, just as if it was like to Red Bull energy drinks or espresso coffee, you know. It's just like they can't wait to get in the meditation hall to get their shot. And then also because the energetic effects, they support wakefulness. So they can mean that the mind is much more alert through more hours of the day. It's not intrinsically unwholesome, but if the mind takes hold of it, it can be something that people really get addicted to and want to just keep perpetuating because of the charge they get from it, just like being addicted to coffee or Red Bull or any kind of thing that electrifies the system, charges up the system. And so it can be quite a stopping point. It's one of those pieces of advice that some people don't want to hear sometimes, like that what you're experiencing and what you spent hours and hours developing and rejoicing in, it's like, yeah, best if you can let go of that and get beyond it. It's like, no, you can't take this away from me. There can be a strong sense of happiness and pleasure, fulfillment, you know. I'm doing well with my practice. This is really, really great because I've got all this energy, all this brightness, and it feels kind of exciting, interesting, and charged. The mind is labeling that as an intrinsic good, and then it's become an object of addiction or a means of addiction. 7 o'clock has come and gone, so let's leave it there for today.